A Russian warplane is shot down at Turkey's border with Syria. Today, we'll tell you about a local symposium on the issues surrounding the refugees fleeing civil war. That's just ahead. And good morning, live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Show is always live at 9, and now subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, we will take your calls on the debate over Syrian refugees. Get on the line now with your thoughts and comments. 549-2937. Also this morning, how to combat bullying in the workplace. A conversation with author Andrew Foss about his book, The Bully's Trap. Plus, how the First Coast program Art Ventures is celebrating 25 years of supporting local artistic talent. We'll tell you all about it. All of that ahead. But first this hour, some breaking news this morning. A Russian warplane has allegedly been shot down near Turkey's border with Syria. Turkey says it responded to the plane after the aircraft repeatedly violated its airspace and ignored several warnings. NATO has called an extraordinary meeting later today to discuss the incident. Syria, of course, has been embroiled for 4.5 years in a brutal civil war that has killed hundreds of thousands, sent millions more fleeing, and laid waste to entire cities. This incident at the border with Turkey comes as, here in America, we continue a heated debate about the resettlement of Syrian refugees and the president's proposal to allow 10,000 refugees fleeing the conflict to come here to our shores. Today, Florida Coastal School of Law will host a panel discussion on the crisis and the legal issues around refugee resettlement. Joining us now with a preview, we are pleased to welcome Erica Curran, immigration attorney and clinic director with Florida Coastal. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Florida Coastal law student Elizabeth Lazar. Her family are Assyrian Christians, originally from Iraq. They fled persecution there a few decades ago. Elizabeth, thanks for sharing your story.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
And we want your calls right now. What are your thoughts about the Syrian refugee crisis, legislation that would block resettlement in this country as well? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on our Facebook page. Erica Curran, let's begin with you. You'll be holding this session today at noon, just as we learned there's been an incident at the Turkey-Syria border. A Russian warplane shot down as the conflict in that region intensifies, a region of the world simply roiling with strife. And it presents a dark backdrop to this debate we're having in America about the resettlement of refugees trying to flee persecution, flee conflict, flee war.
Yes, Melissa. I mean, we wanted to do this panel today because we want to really highlight and get information out to the community about the refugee resettlement. Refugees are subject to the high level of security checks in the immigrant population in the United States. And we've only, since the conflict began in 2011, accepted around 2,000 Syrian refugees in the United States.
That's right. In 2015, two families from Syria are estimated to arrive here in Jacksonville through World Relief, one of the primary resettlement agencies. At the same time, in Washington, lawmakers are looking at a bill that's currently in the House that would block refugee resettlement. How will that issue come up during today's discussion?
Well, we want to explain what the security check process currently is. And that extra measure that is in the bill really is, you know, unnecessary because we have such stringent checks. U.S. security agencies screen the refugee candidates at overseas. And the process, most of the refugees that would be coming to the United States would be women and children, male children under 10 or 12 years of age. And approximately, you know, 70% of those refugees would be women and children. And a lot of the concern is about young men. And so we're seeing a different population than they're seeing in Europe.
The concern is young men, obviously.
Fighting age.
And we'll go to your calls on this in a moment at 549-2937. The House expected to vote on a Republican bill that would, as new Speaker Paul Ryan explains, pause the acceptance of refugees in the aftermath of the Paris attacks. the White House is issuing a veto threat to this measure. What are your thoughts about that, Erica Curran?
Well, I think Congress was very reactionary and not spending, our leaders weren't spending enough time looking at the current refugee processing. And yes, the bill would pause refugee processing because it's adding an additional step that we're not prepared to implement immediately. We already, you know, clear refugees through the National Counterterrorism Center, the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, and the State Department. And if you ask any immigration attorney, the amount of time it takes to get a refugee to the United States is between 18 months and 36 months. And then there's a whole nother set of security checks. Once you're a refugee, you're resettled in the United States, you're required to apply for permanent residence within 1 year, and then you go through additional security checks. So no population is screened at a greater level currently.
Let's hear now from Elizabeth Lazar, a law student at Florida Coastal. Your family left Iraq decades ago to save themselves, to flee persecution. Can you share a little bit about your family's story?
Yes. They left Iraq in the late 60s, early 70s, in order to escape both religious and ethnic persecution, since we are Assyrian Christians. But they have been one thing that I keep on hearing constantly from all members of my family who lived in Iraq is that during their time there, it wasn't such a conflict as the media makes it now between Christians and Muslims. Actually, they lived together as neighbors, cared for each other as neighbors. A lot of times with my family, it was actually their Muslim neighbors who helped them escape Iraq and helped provide them with that support that they needed. So that is one thing that I wanted to emphasize is what I've been hearing some people say is, okay, perhaps we could accept the Christian refugees and not the Muslim refugees. And that's absolutely unacceptable because both groups are being persecuted. Both groups are victims, and they do need humanitarian help from this.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. Some of the Republican presidential candidates, Jeb Bush, actually walked back his initial statement saying he would be open to Christian Syrians, but not Muslim Syrians. Your family's perspective is one of remembering a time before extremism overtook Iraq and different religious groups coexisted. What would you say to those listening who might argue, well, that's not the case today?
Well, today the problems that we see aren't coming at the hands of average civilians. They are Daesh, the extremists are doing it, and it's also sometimes government sponsored violence or discrimination. It isn't the average civilian who is seeking refuge with us right now. So there is a difference. We have to see at who is causing the problems, and it's not the refugees. It is the extremists, such as Daesh, or members of the government.
And Daesh, another term for ISIS. Erica Curran, here in this country, the majority of Americans polled say they support the position of not allowing any more refugees from this region into America. What are your thoughts about that polling?
I think it's fear, and people need to rely on their government officials and people in power to give them good, accurate information so they can make good decisions. And we have not really seen that. This is hot on a political time period, and so there's a lot of statements flying around. There's a lot of inaccuracies, and I think, you know, it's a lack of information. Part of why we wanted to do this panel with our students, we want to send them home for the holidays so that they can have an accurate conversation with their family about what is the refugee resettlement process? What is our obligation under international law? What is a refugee? A refugee is someone who is fleeing persecution based on religion, political beliefs. And we have a lengthy history of being a safe haven for refugees. We've been a leader in this, and we need to continue to be so.
As you said, 3 million resettled in this country through the length of the program over several decades.
Mm-hmm.
You posed the question, though, what is our obligation under international law? Well, what is our obligation?
Well, we signed the UN Refugee Convention in 1968, and then we codified that into our own immigration laws in 1980. And we've committed, last year we resettled 85,000 refugees. We've committed to from all over the world. Here in Florida, the bulk of the refugees and asylum seekers that we've resettled were from Cuba because of our proximity to Cuba. But we do play a role in offering safety and security to refugees and asylum seekers. Our clinic predominantly works with asylum seekers, and we have represented Syrians fleeing just some of the worst persecution I have ever in my career heard of.
Elizabeth.
Yes. I'm also helping asylum victims right now with their claims, and I've also heard horrible stories of just what they have been through. And
can you share a few of them?
I can't share any of the personal stories, but some of them are like my own. Some of them are completely different. But you really, at the clinic, I have been able to see a diverse group of clients. And actually, that's one of the experiences I'm thankful for at the school. I don't think I would have been able to get that experience anywhere else. But it is heartbreaking, truly, to hear what they have to say. And their biggest fear is, please don't send me back to the horror that I came from.
Erica.
And I think just that image of the little boy on the beach, I know so many of my friends, and I'm a mom, you know, you just think about what would drive a family to throw themselves in a boat and cross an ocean. Like, that's not economic migration. That's absolute terror of what lies behind you to face such fear crossing an ocean like that.
And we'll go to your calls in just a moment. A few comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Scott writes, of course we should allow them to come and help them resettle. How often do you get the chance to literally save thousands of lives? If all lives matter, here's our chance to prove it. From Glenn, get support from Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Kuwait. Let them finance a Syrian refugee facility in Syria and take in some of their fellow Muslims. What about that argument? Elizabeth.
I agree that they should open their borders, absolutely. But that doesn't influence what our action should be as well. We have also signed the Treaty for Refugees, and we should also accept. So
let's go to your calls right now as we discuss Florida Coastal's panel coming up today at noon on the Florida Coastal School of Law campus, looking at the Syrian refugee resettlement issue. This as Turkey downs a Russian warplane at their border with Syria this morning. NATO will be holding a meeting about that later today, and the number to join the show is 549-2937. Let's go now to Robert in Riverside with us. Hello, Robert. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I support green and red.
Okay, Robert, we've got a really bad connection there. Why don't you give us a call back? 549-2937, Richard in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Yes. I want to say just a few things, and that is I'm a little bit older than most of the panelists. And, you know, World War II, we had, while the Jews were being annihilated in Europe, we had a ship full of Jews trying to escape in New York Harbor, and this country refused them. And I said to myself, you know, this will never happen again in history. And then we all know how the Japanese citizens, U.S. citizens, are treated during World War II. But it seems like, unfortunately, history continues to repeat itself. And what I don't understand is I understand the fear that people have about terrorists coming over, but why couldn't we let the children in, or the mothers and the children in, and then really screen the men very, very well? You know, there's other things that can be done. And for the life of me, you know, we're mostly a Christian country. And how in the world that we're allowing what's going on without taking a big part in trying to help the problem? I have no idea. You know, we all need in this country to appeal to our better angels. That's all I've got to say.
Thank you, Richard. And he is referring to the ship, the St. Louis, in 1939, under President Roosevelt. That ship was turned away, Erica Curran, a ship full of Jewish refugees. Some of them did end up dying in the Holocaust. Another example he referenced that's come up a lot in recent days is the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. The actor from Star Trek, George Takei, has mounted a Broadway show about his family's experience being interned, called Allegiance. So these issues come up again and again in this country.
Yeah, I think we can really learn from history. Those moments when we are afraid are moments when I think we shouldn't be making decisions. We need to stop, pause, and think. about what we're doing. And we already have some of the most stringent processes for reviewing refugee applications. And we are only resettling individuals who've passed through significant screenings. And over 50% of the folks referred for refugee screening to the United States from the UN actually pass muster. So there's so much that goes into it. And 70% of the refugees we anticipate resettling, if we still can, would be women and children, the most vulnerable.
What would you say to those who cite one data point that over the decades of the refugee program, there have been a few incidents of individuals, just a handful, who did pass screening but then were later apprehended as they were allegedly planning some act of terrorism? They were not able to carry it out.
Yeah, the statistics I've seen puts that at such a low percentage point, and it's much lower than the domestic terrorist population statistically that we've experienced within our own country.
Brian in Jacksonville, thanks for holding. Brian, you're on the air.
Melissa, good morning. First off, I strongly support Richard's sentiments. I'm in the military active duty, and I've served multiple tours over in the Middle East, and I've seen what these people come from. And I really fear how history will judge us and how our children will judge us if we do not do more to support these people.
Brian, thanks for your call. And we want your thoughts on this issue. Lots of calls at 549-2937. George on the South Side. Hi, George. What are your thoughts?
Hey, I just want to tell you that you're not looking at this issue in the right perspective. The U.S. is the one that is promoting a civil war in Syria, and they are creating this refugee issue. We are dropping ammunition. We are training opposition, as we call them, but they all are just terrorists, and they are attacking civilians and creating this refugee issue. I think we should look at it as how can we fix this refugee issue and not how what we're going to do with the refugees. I mean, that's a moot point.
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Well, I don't like the statement where he just said that they are all terrorists. That is the kind of mentality that we need to get rid of. Not everyone in the Middle East is a terrorist. It's a diverse people with diverse cultures, each who have amazing things to offer this country. The U.S. has had involvement, but usually it is to help resolve humanitarian issues, help solve human rights violations. So careful with the phrasing on that. We can't have that mentality spread.
Joe in Jacksonville. Hi, Joe. Good morning. Go ahead, Joe.
Good morning. Much sympathy to the victims. But I just have one statement to make. With all the humanitarian sympathy that we have for everything that's going on, has anyone actually looked at how it's changing the dynamics of America and the values that we cherish? In the one issue that has been beaten to death is the prayer in schools. How are we addressing those issues?
I appreciate that, but we're taking calls today on the Syrian refugee crisis, so thanks for that. Ed in Fleming Island. Hi, Ed. Good morning.
Yes, hi. I think that we've done this before in many ways. There should be some priorities as an example. Usually we prioritize people who have proof of persecution. And I think one way to accept the refugees is by order of likelihood of being beheaded. That be all the minority religions, whether it's Christian, Yazidis, which are not Christian, but any minority, also Muslim religion. Also, especially for people like one of your guests who have a lot of Syrian American, many friends I have which are from Syrian American, who are here who can vouch for family members. If they can identify those particular people, I think that should be a priority. They also can guarantee perhaps they won't become a burden to the taxpayer. That has been done before with refugee programs, where the families here would guarantee the refugees coming over won't be a burden. Also, obviously, a priority to families versus single men. So there's a lot of different steps that can be taken. Now, the comparison to other past refugee situations, whether it's the Jews or people like the Vietnamese and the Cubans recently. Here's the difference. There's a very valid concern for people because the Jews, the Cubans, the Vietnamese did not go around blowing up restaurants and movie theaters and so on. So it is a fear, unfortunately, that is very valid anywhere in the world. So, but there are ways to accept these people in a logical matter by status of persecution, families here in the United States, and status of family units.
All right. Thanks, Ed. Yes. Thank you, Ed. A similar tweet coming in from Maybell. What about a Mariel boatlift type model? Why can't Syrians be claimed by family and friends from a central location? What about their comments? As he pointed out, this area does have a very high population of Syrian Americans.
So there is already a process in place, a tiered process, where we prioritize refugees based on their ability to, they have to prove that they would face persecution and meet a standard for what is a refugee, which is a really tough standard. I try these cases in the U.S., and it's really, really hard to get a grant of asylum in the United States. And they have to do that overseas with our USCIS, Department of Homeland Security, and the referrals come from the U.N. We also do have a process whereby, family unity is a factor in resettlement of refugees.
Elizabeth, as Ed pointed out, Americans have concerns about admitting Muslims from the Middle East to our shores. Let's look at the website factcheck.org. The vast majority of Syrian refugees coming into this country are Sunni Muslims. They make up about 74% of the Syrian population, and they tend to oppose the regime of dictator Assad. They are subject to ethnic cleansing and violence and persecution. That is why they are fleeing the civil war in Syria, because of the divide between Sunni and Shiite, among other factors. What would you say, though, to callers like Ed who say, we have a valid concern about allowing Muslims into this country? Many Americans now conflate Islam as a whole with terrorism. Right or wrong, that is the perception many Americans now hold. What would you say to those Americans?
I would say that we need to broaden our mind. That is definitely a misconception. There are bad people and good people in every ethnicity and every religion. And we have had American terrorists who are not Muslim, who are Christian, and who have caused mass killings here in the U.S. So it's not, we should not equate someone who is Muslim with being a terrorist.
Zunera is in Orange Park. Hi, Zunera.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Okay, so I know there's a sense of fear that's coming on from people because of the media and how they portray Muslim Americans and Muslims around the world, but that's not the reason why we shouldn't take in the Syrian refugees. These people are being oppressed in their homeland by ISIS and by Assad, and that's what they're trying to flee. And we need to help them here, and it's just a sense of humanity to try and help other humans out, these people that are being hurt over there. So it's not a sense of religion. We need to see that they are also humans being killed, and we need to take that into account when we bring them over here.
Zunera, thanks so much. Tim on the West Side, go ahead, Tim.
Yeah, I'm just kind of grieved by the politicians blustering over this issue, and I was wondering if they're going to put a qualifier on the Statue of Liberty about yearning masses, subtle masses, yearning to breathe free. It just grieves me that this is such an issue. We should be compassionate. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Susan in Kingsland, Georgia. Susan, your thoughts.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted a quick question to your panelists. Can she just touch on why certain countries are not taking Syrians in, like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Australia, and that these rich countries, are giving money to Germany to help house these Syrians? I'll take my answer off the air, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. Erica.
I think that's an excellent point. And I think part of the problem with our focusing on we're not going to accept refugees is we've diverted from a broader dialogue about the bigger problem. And I think more Middle Eastern countries do. Although the countries that have the most refugees currently are Jordan and Turkey, and they're not able to offer them a sustainable resettlement.
We are more equipped financially, with infrastructure, logistically, to enable refugees to resettle and build a new life.
And it just reminds me of, I think it was Iceland, where people in Iceland were willing to take refugees into their homes. And what, you know, a small country that is. But I saw that in the first weeks after we saw that image of the little boy on the beach. People in Jacksonville, people in our community reaching out, how can we help? And let's not forget that image.
Calls from across the listening area. Let's go now to Mitchell in Palatka. Hi, Mitchell.
Yes, I think that we should not let Germany and Sweden do such a fantastic job and we fall down completely. Admittedly, this sort of immigration can never be perfectly safe, but we should greatly increase the number that we allow in, and it'll probably help to drive up the price of goats.
Mitchell, thanks. Carol on the West Side. Hi, Carol. Good morning.
Hello. My thoughts. I just wonder.
Hey, Carol, turn your radio down, please.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead, Carol.
Here, I'm turning it down right now.
Okay.
On the West Side.
Hi, Carol. Go ahead.
Okay. My question or my thought is, I just wonder if the Indians had had that foresight and opportunity when all those Europeans stormed in here and took their country, if they had been the same way. We owe the world. We owe. And it's just ridiculous to me that any politician can say, no, we don't want them. There's got to be a way to do it. We are the land of the free and the home of the brave. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. Elizabeth, as you mentioned a moment ago, many refugees have made incredible contributions to this country. In fact, when we talked about this issue last week, someone emailed the show to point out that the late Steve Jobs was the son of a Syrian refugee immigrant. Tell us about your family and how they ended up contributing to this country.
Well, my family, I could say that we have been very outspoken on this subject since we've been allowed in. The fact that I am here on the radio talking, that is something that I would not be able to do had my parents not immigrated. I'm thankful for the opportunities that I've been given here in this country because I am a law student and I will be an attorney someday and I'll be helping Americans and immigrants alike. And even in my family, we have my father who retired from General Motors. He was a mechanical engineer there. And, I mean, We really did just adopt this new homeland as our own, and we've contributed to it. We've taken from the education system. I mean, we've you know, enrolled in the education system, something that we wouldn't have been able to do back home. And by back home, I mean in Iraq, actually, where I've never been. But there's so much freedom, so much to be offered to us here that we take advantage of it as much as we can because these are privileges that were denied in Iraq.
It's been so insightful to hear from both of you this morning. Again, Florida Coastal School of Law will be hosting a panel discussion today at noon on their campus in room 250, looking at the issues around refugee resettlement. Stop by. Thanks for being with us, Erica Curran, immigration attorney and clinic director, and Florida Coastal Law student Elizabeth Lazar, both with us in studio. Thanks.
Thank you.
And much more still ahead. Later in the hour, we'll tell you how local artists are celebrating 25 years of grants on the First Coast, helping them spread their vision all around the country. But up next, how to fight bullying in the workplace, a conversation with author Andrew Foss. That's in a moment.
As the global climate summit approaches, the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, China, has a lot at risk.
Shanghai has by far the largest number of people on land that would be submerged in a 4-degree C warming scenario.
China and the environment, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Weekday afternoons from 4 to 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Join WJCT December 15th at the WJCT Studios as we celebrate the final season of Downton Abbey with a cocktail reception and a sneak preview of Season 6. Reception begins at 6:30 with the preview event to begin at 7:30. Tickets are $30 and include a chance to win a Downton weekend at Sea Island. Costumes are optional but encouraged. More info at wjct.org/events or 358-6327.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we're on site in Uptown Chicago.
The Green Mill is the greatest place on earth.
It's just this magical, wondrous place with all this period decoration.
Music from Sabretooth Organ Quartet.
I call it back alley jazz, but it's really not. It's so talented.
It's an after-hours jazz party at the Green Mill. That's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, we often think of bullying as something that affects our kids at school. But bullying in the workplace among adults is also a serious problem. A recent New York Times expose looking at the allegedly toxic culture of online retailer Amazon is just one example that's made headlines this year. Author Andrew Foss writes that bullying in the workplace can destroy careers, lives, families, organizations, even whole communities. And he says many companies condone and sometimes even encourage bullying, but often they don't even realize it. Foss examines this dynamic and offers solutions for both managers and employees in his new book, The Bully's Trap. Andrew Foss, a pleasure.
Thanks, Melissa.
I think this is a topic that interests almost anyone who works in any office, because this is a rampant problem, you write. And you have data to back it up, too.
I do. And we're actually gaining more and more data as time goes on. And since the book was written, I've received hundreds of comments. And as you indicated, in many cases, people didn't realize or don't realize that they are being bullied until they're well into the situation.
And why is that?
Well, bullying in schools is written about, and when people hear the word bullying, they automatically associate it with schools. And very rarely do they associate it in the workplace. So I'm actually writing a third edition, and I'm retitling the book to asking the question, is your workplace psychologically safe? And when people hear the words harassment, abuse, extortion, and bullying, they then recognize, yes, that is going on in my organization.
And often blatant examples of harassment are easy to spot. But as you write, often bullying in the office can be very subtle.
And complex.
What are some examples of that?
Well, exclusion from meetings, withholding information that they need to do their job, gossiping about them, being nice to them to their face, and then discrediting them to others. And that's what makes it so complex, and it makes people realize or fail to realize that they are targeted.
And you've had experience in your own corporate career with this, which is, can you tell us what inspired you to write this book?
Sure. Well, I offer a perspective which is somewhat unusual, in so much that early in my career, I was called out for being a bully.
Really?
And it was a great experience, because I learned young that fear or respect is actually a far more powerful motivator than fear.
And you advise CEOs and managers of this. Your Foss Foundation and Healthy Workplace Initiative has really tried to attack this problem in corporate America. when you go and talk with companies, they tell you, well, we don't have bullying, or if we do, we want to fix it. But yes. You, as you write, very often they don't understand. The CEO really doesn't recognize the true extent of the problem in his or her own company.
Well, usually the CEO does not get the information that they need to hear. And I get a lot of pushback from executives who say, well, not in my environment.
Denial is common.
It's real denial. And they cite enlightened human resource people. They cite their engagement surveys. They cite employee assistance programs and other feedback mechanisms. But if people don't trust the executive and by extension the organization, they will not trust the mechanisms that provide feedback. And the statistic that I often cite is over 70% of North American workers are not engaged. And the reason that they're not engaged usually is because they do not respect their boss and by extension the organization they work for.
And so they check out, and that leads in turn to a decline in the bottom line. As you cite, companies with low engagement have a 33% annual decline in operating income and an 11% decline in growth. Happy workers mean a productive, profit-making enterprise. But too many American workers are unhappy, they feel stressed, and they sometimes or often feel bullied.
Yes, and the bullying factor is usually the most predominant dynamic that's at play. And bullying creates attitude problems. It creates performance problems. And that's why I call the book The Bully's Trap. People fall into that. And when they fall into it, they give the bully the ammunition to let them go, which is often the primary motivation for the bully.
How then can you pull a company out of this toxic dynamic if there is so much denial and it is so widespread? How do you work with companies and managers to change this dynamic?
Well, first get them to understand what's going on in their organization and ask them the question, are you really hearing what you need to hear? And there's many ways they can do that. The other thing I do is say, would you like to be the CEO of Amazon in light of this expose? Or would you like to be the CEO of Volkswagen? Or would you like to be the CEO of Wells Fargo, who are facing upheaval because they did not have cultures whereby people expressed concern about what was going on in their environment.
Whistleblowers, as you write, fear to come forward. They fear retaliation if they speak openly about dysfunction in the workplace.
Yes. And that's actually what happened to me late in my career. I was called out for exposing a corrupt executive. And I went through 18 months of sheer hell. And if I went through that, I can't imagine what people who aren't as familiar as I am on bullying and harassment and abuse, I can't imagine what those people went through. I need to define closure, because I was directing all of my energy to negative energy thinking about this. And I needed to switch that to positive energy, and that's the reason I got into the topic and the book. And the book is merely a method by which we can open the discussion and the debate on what I think is a major, major epidemic in the workplace.
And as we speak with author Andrew Foss about his book, The Bully's Trap. Let's go now to Paul in Orange Park. Hi, Paul. Good morning.
Good morning. Great topic. Thank you for taking my call. I took a job in 2001, the large corporation, which I'll remain nameless, and I had 6 months of very intensive training in computer programming. And in the class, there was two young men who caught on to all this, quite easily. I was 51 and, never really worked on computers that much. And they verbally harassed me right in the middle of class. I'd ask a question and they'd just get on my case. And you think, you know, why can't you learn this? You know, what's your problem? And the teacher did nothing. And, you know, it took me 6 months working in the facility where I was going to be working before I finally, you know, I got chosen employee of the month. And one of the guys that had been harassing me came over to me one day and says, you know, I guess you're not as stupid as I thought you were. But I tell you what, you know, at age 51, it was really emotionally draining. But I had, you know, God gave me the peace to, you know, answer back and say, well, you know, I'm really glad it's easy for you to learn this, but I had to work harder. It's a very emotional, painful situation.
Sure. So
thank you.
Thanks for sharing that, Paul. The trauma can last for a long time if somebody has a negative workplace experience.
Well, like I indicated earlier, it's all consuming, and the most difficult thing that people have is, was indicated by the call-in person who called in. Closure is very difficult to find. 80% of people who are severely bullied suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Did you?
I did. I had the symptoms. I was not diagnosed, but I had the symptoms consistent with it. And when you look at the long-term impact of that, and we're seeing that with vets, and that's getting more exposure, but it's exactly the same thing with employees. And it also extends to the person's family, because usually that person develops other problems, addiction, and depression, and they end up, in many instances, becoming the bully at home. And the impact that that has on the children, long-term impact that that has on the children, is a huge issue. And it's an area that I'm really delving into, just really understanding the impact to the individual and to the organizations down the road.
And so the bully's trap is out now. Your initiative for a healthy workplace is also operating. Do you have another book planned?
I do. And it's called Is Your Workplace Psychologically Safe? And the subheading on it is deals with harassment, abuse, bullying, coercion, intimidation, and there's a whole number of things that go on that really should fall under the umbrella of bullying, because that's what it is. But it's really to make people aware of what is going on out there. The caller mentioned, and I'll just end with this, that it was younger people who were harassing him. And I'm really worried, based on what's going on in the schools, that we're teaching the millennials the wrong thing in terms of how to correct the wrongs of the world. And they're going to be facing a tough world when they get into the workforce.
Well, I hope and pray that they make it through. It's tough out there for all of us, isn't it? He's author Andrew Foss, and the book is The Bully's Trap. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
In a moment, the Community Foundation celebrates 25 years of supporting local artists.
On the next Fresh Air, how ISIS is trying to acquire a lethal substance called red mercury to weaponize into a doomsday bomb. But red mercury doesn't exist. We'll talk with New York Times reporter C.J. Chivers about his article, The Doomsday Scam. And we'll talk about the weapons ISIS has managed to get its hands on and how it got them. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back, and finally this hour, a special anniversary. This year marks 25 years that the Community Foundation of Northeast Florida has been awarding grants to individual artists and arts organizations through its Art Ventures Fund. What began back in 1989 as a challenge grant from the National Endowment of the Arts has grown over the years to a robust program that's awarded more than $1 million in grants to dozens of local talents. Now, some have gone on to national renown, like our own 89.9 WJCT host Al Letson. The big anniversary will be celebrated next week at a special event at the city's Museum of Contemporary Art. We've got a preview right now as we welcome Amy Crane, Program Director with Community Foundation of Northeast Florida. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Melissa.
And one of the co-founders of Art Ventures, renowned local artist Jim Draper. Good to see you.
Good morning.
So 25 years of Art Ventures, that's a lot of art that's been supported over the years, Amy.
It is, and about 150 grants have been made to individual artists and almost 100 to the small arts organizations that have received grants, and it's really is a testimony to the incredible talent that is here in Northeast Florida and the dedication of those small arts organizations who continue to produce really fine work.
And Jim, you received an Art Ventures grant. You also helped co-found this whole venture some time ago. How did it all get started?
Well, I did receive an Art Ventures grant in 1999, I actually got into the was added on to the. I really didn't help co-found the event. I was fortunate to get the grant in 99, but it was I certainly took benefit from the from what. All those that had come before from Ann Baker and Courtney Wilson and the group that started it.
So. How did it help you? It was $10,000?
I got $5,000 to further my screen printing interest. And it was really beneficial to me at a good time because I was moving into the idea of screen printing and needed to get some equipment. And I was just beginning my career in Jacksonville and pushing forward and trying to expand. And so it was very beneficial for me at the time, and it was a great thing for me.
Sure. So these small grants have helped individual artists and also arts organizations like Riverside Fine Arts, Beaches Fine Arts, and Friday Musicale.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of art being supported all over town.
It's true. And actually, what's exciting about the partnership that Jim is part of for December 2nd, which is when the exhibit opens to the public, is that UNF and MOCA have come together to offer the 8 artists who received grants this year in 2015 the opportunity to show their work. And so Jim should take some credit along with Deborah Murphy over at UNF for helping us put together this really exciting opportunity to show these 8 artists off because
That's
they
right.
are outstanding.
A big event coming up on December 1st, and the show will run from December 2nd through January 17th. What's going to be happening next week?
Well, next week we have on Art Walk Night, Wednesday night, we'll have open to the public an exhibition of the 8 artists who have received the 2015 Art Ventures Grants Awards in the UNF Gallery at MOCA on the second floor. It's going to be an exciting show. We've been working on it now for, oh goodness, since August when they were announced. So we've been meeting with the artists and planning this incredible exhibition.
And as I mentioned, our own Al Letson, who went on to host State of the Reunion and now hosts a national program called Reveal, he got started with one of these grants.
He did. And it was interesting. I like Al's story because he talks about his the very first opportunity that he had with Art Ventures was actually through Dan Solomon, who is a filmmaker, and Dan wanted to highlight Al's work, and so it was a wonderful collaboration of two artists coming together and getting the benefit of Art Ventures, and then Al himself went on to apply for several grants. I believe that he has gotten either 2 or 3, and so they've been at seminal points of his career, things that gave him an opportunity to be able to produce a show off Broadway, and so the wealth of talent in Northeast Florida, it's extraordinary, and it's something to be celebrated. And looking back over 25 years gives us the opportunity to do that.
And you'll celebrate that at a special event a week from tonight, yes?
Yes. So what we're looking forward to is the opportunity to showcase these eight artists. And if you'll allow me to say their names, because I think it's really, it's such a great group. Fabricio Farias, he is a visual artist. Roy Berry, who's a photographer. Patrick Berry, who's a filmmaker. Anna Paula Habib, who is also a filmmaker. Daryl Rubin Hall, who's a musical composer but also an actor. Kate Rue, who is a mosaicist. A lot of people know her project on the South Bank Riverwalk. Tony Walsh, he's from Clay County, and he was also the former director of the Thrasher Horn Center. So people know Tony, and he produced a wonderful theater piece. And last but not least is Hiromi Moneyhun, who's an extraordinary paper cut artist who people really have heard so much about. So it's a wonderful group.
It sure is. And if you're listening and this is the first time you've heard about the Art Ventures grants, get in touch with the Community Foundation and find out about the next cycle.
Yes, and it'll start January 1st, actually. They'll be posted on our website. And so please follow that with us so that you can learn more about the program.
Kudos on a great 25 years. And thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Amy Crane is Program Director with the Community Foundation. Also with us, Jim Draper this morning, artist and curator for the new UNF Gallery at MoCA, and an exhibit of eight artists who won Art Ventures grants this year. Check it out beginning December 2nd. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Shevchuk. Never miss a program. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, the country's 911 system was designed for landline phones, but with the growing reliance on mobile technology, experts say it's out of date. Current gaps in the 911 system and how to improve it. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.